It is The Morning Show. I'm Kate Archer-Kent. Glad you could be here. We dig into the imposter phenomenon now, first described by psychologists in the late 70s, and their abstract reads, an internal experience of intellectual phoniness that appears to be particularly prevalent and intense among a select sample of high-achieving women. Fast forward to a study in the Journal of General Internal Medicine in 2020, it concludes clinicians and employers should be mindful of the prevalence of imposter syndrome in the workforce. Join in on doubting your abilities, feeling like your accomplishments are just luck. 800-642-1234. Valerie Young co-founded the Imposter Syndrome Institute. Its mission is to stamp out imposter syndrome. Valerie, welcome to the Ideas Network.
Thanks so much for inviting me, Kate.
Well, some studies have shown that imposter syndrome is more common in the college environment among underrepresented students, like people of color or first-generation college students. How can it affect a person's education?
Oh, gosh, in so many ways, Kate. First of all, just the reason why it's prevalent, especially in students, let's just take students as a group, and we'll talk about the other groups in a second, is it makes perfect sense when you think about it, right? I'm all about normalizing imposter syndrome and doing less psychologizing and more contextualizing. So when you're a student, you are in this population where your knowledge and your intellect is literally being tested day in and day out. And that's one reason why it is just rampant at college campuses, not just among students, by the way, but also amongst faculty and staff. In terms of first generation students, often referred to as kind of first gen, absolutely. I mean, if you don't have those role models, you don't have that kind of collective community experience of being at college, or perhaps you didn't come out of the best school system, it can add stress if you're also having to have a couple of jobs to keep to be able to even go to school, and you've got other outside pressures. You do see it a lot in women on college campuses, partly because confidence is lower amongst women who are in their 20s than men, generally speaking. There's some research on that. And you're going to see it a lot in the STEM fields with women as well. Any field where there's not a lot of people who look like you, and there are fewer women. And certainly, people of color, and I'd say women, people with disabilities, first generation, international students, whenever you're on the receiving end of stereotypes about competence or intelligence, you're much more susceptible to imposter feelings.
You said imposter feelings there, and I wonder, do you think the word syndrome has baggage, or that it connects to women in a condescending way?
It has baggage if you're a psychologist and you're an academic. The actual original term by Pauline Clance and Suzanne Ives, those are the two psychologists who coined the term in 1978, was the imposter phenomenon. Mm-hmm. And I asked the Library of Congress to kind of look into, like, when did it start becoming imposter syndrome? I first used that term in 1985. I wrote an article for a magazine. Another usage was found in 1983. So yeah, if you're in psychology, you're an academic, there's a lot of resistance to the word syndrome because it would suggest, a psychologically diagnosable kind of condition or, mental illness of some sort, of which it is not and never was. It's popularly referred to outside of academia as imposter syndrome. And I think for most of us, we look at it in terms of the second dictionary definition, which is a set of thoughts and patterns and behaviors, thoughts, feelings, and behaviors that kind of form a pattern. So that's how I use the term syndrome.
As you mentioned there, it's not a mental health diagnosis. It isn't classified as a disorder in the American Psychiatric Association's Diagnostic and Statistical Manual. Does that omission affect how we study it, how we treat it, how we talk about it?
I'm not a psychologist, so I'm not sure if it affects how we study it, because it is a heavily researched phenomenon, especially in psychology, but also there's studies in the field of nursing and in the field of business as well. So I'm not sure, on the academic side, how it affects how we study it. I will say that, it is something that we need to take seriously. For some people, it's a mild kind of case with not, you know, huge consequences, but, you know, on the university level, on the student level, there are consequences. It could be students who drop out, who decide that they're really not up to the task, when in fact they are, you know, but they're just feeling like they're inadequate compared to their peers. It could be the student who, on the other end of the continuum, who consistently overworks, overprepares, and so they burn out, and that's has negative consequences as well.
We're talking about imposter syndrome, what it is, what it means to grapple with these feelings. Valerie Young is co-founder of the Imposter Syndrome Institute, an author, international speaker. You can join in on how you have grappled with these feelings and what how it has affected your education, your career path. 800-642-1234. Email ideas at WPR.org. I'm wondering, Valerie, have we evolved our thinking on imposter syndrome since it was first described by the psychologists in the 70s? Have things changed about it?
You know, I think that we have. It's really part of the popular conversation now, when it was previously something that was primarily studied academically. I think a big shift is that organizations, whether it's universities, and I've spoken at over 100 universities around the world, which, you know, I'm telling you that just to give you an idea of what an how big of an issue it is on college campuses, but also large companies and organizations are also looking at the behaviors associated with imposter syndrome. In other words, they're realizing this is not just an interesting self-help topic, that there are costs and consequences, not just for the individual student or staff member or faculty or employee, but also for the organization. I think that's the big evolution.
How should companies grapple with it? I mean, how should they do their feedback, their performance evaluations? How can they communicate with people who are really great at their jobs, you know, given a person may be struggling with imposter syndrome?
Yeah, that's a great question, Kate. And I think part of it comes down to, and one of the tools I recommend is to normalize imposter syndrome. And what that means in part is talking about it, right? Giving voice to these nebulous feelings of fraudulence. And to do that on an organizational level is really important as well. I read about a company who in their job posting at the bottom, it said, "We understand the confidence gap and imposter syndrome are real, we want you to imply." So great example of normalizing in the organization. When you talk about it at an organizational level with managers and so on, I really encourage people to not talk about it in that confessional kind of way, like, "Oh my God, Kate, I felt like such an imposter in that big meeting today," right? Mm-hmm. But you want to do it in a way that's like offhanded, matter of fact, so that people go, "Oh, what do you mean?" And "Oh, you've never heard of it? It's very common." And to talk about it. It should be part of new hire orientation. It should be part of new student orientation. It should be part of management training. And also, I think misunderstanding that the only people who feel it, like, you can tell, right? And let's be clear, there are people who you can really tell sometimes that they're struggling with confidence, but it could be a very senior, incredibly successful person who's won the MacArthur Genius Award. I mean, I did a faculty session with a guy who had won that award, who you would not look at them and go, "Oh, they have imposter syndrome." Hmm. So people who are able to project confidence and, you know, carry on and do their work, but they're still experiencing this. So we can't make assumptions about who that person is in the organization.
You just mentioned men. For a long time, this was really pegged to women. Are men talking about it?
Oh, much more, much more. You know, when I started doing this work nearly 40 years ago, the focus really was on women, because that's who Clance and Imes observed. That's who they were doing therapy with. That's who was in the groups where these issues kept coming up. But the conversation has really shifted, where many more men show up at events, are interested at very senior levels as well. So it is not unique to women. You know, that said, the younger you are, the studies are mixed, but what I'm finding is that in the studies where they're looking at college age students, the rates tend to be higher amongst women, because I think you're dealing with a confidence gap there. And then they kind of even out, mid-40s, mid-50s. One study showed women's confidence of men evens out mid-40s, mid-50s, and by 60, women are more confident. By 60, women are like, screw it, I don't care anymore. But that's a really long time to have to wait. And that big gap in the 20s and 30s for women is problematic. Those are very important career platform building years.
Valerie Young with us, expert on imposter syndrome, co-founder of the Imposter Syndrome Institute. Join in on self-doubt, controlling your actions, feeling like you don't deserve your successes, the stature in your career, how you address these issues when they bubble up inside. 800-642-1234. I'm Kate Archer-Kent. You're listening to The Morning Show on the Ideas Network. It is The Morning Show. I'm Kate Archer-Kent. A majority of executive women across a range of industries, they identified with having feelings of inadequacy and self-doubt or imposter syndrome at certain points in their careers. That's the upshot of a study by accounting giant KPMG in 2020. It found 3/4 of executive women report having personally experienced imposter syndrome at some point. Join in on what it's been like for you, what you want to know about how to reframe this thinking. 800-642-1234. We have Valerie Young with us, co-founder of the Imposter Syndrome Institute, wrote a book on why successful women suffer from imposter syndrome and has devoted her life work to this. Let's take a call now. Kelsey is with us from Oconomowoc. Kelsey, hi, what is your story?
Hi, good morning. I just wanted to share, I work in a corporate setting with lots of women who are younger, and I think one of the things I observe in relation to imposter syndrome is women who are not seeking an increase in compensation and are not, never really asking for that raise they may deserve, because we've sort of been conditioned to feel grateful for just having a seat at the table instead of really valuing what we're bringing to that table in a compensatory way.
Kelsey, thank you for that. Do you see that, Valerie?
Yeah, absolutely. And that's one of the, consequences, I would say. There's always going to be some kind of a financial cost to imposter syndrome. And in this great example from Kelsey, it's in not stepping up and asking for it. And partly that could be not feeling deserving. I think women often feel like we need to know 150% right before we step up or raise our hand. But I also think it has to do with this kind of mindset, this belief that if I deserve it, they'll come and give it to me, right? Kind of assuming kind of the system is fair. I'll keep my head down, I'll do my work, and they're going to come up and say, great job, you're going to give me a big raise. When in fact, the system assumes if you think you deserve a raise, you will raise your hand and say, here's why I think I need an increase. Here's what I've done. And here's why I believe I need an increase.
You categorize imposters into these 5 categories to help describe how people measure competence differently. There's the perfectionist and the expert, the naturalist, the superhero, the soloist. Can you tell us what is one of the most common of those?
Oh, gosh. It's impossible to say because people sometimes identify with multiple ones. Mm-hmm. I think at the core of all of them is this inaccurate belief that if I was really intelligent, capable, competent, and then kind of fill in the blank. Right. We have this exaggerated, unrealistic notion of what it means to be competent. And when we hold ourselves to these impossibly high standards, so often I think with imposter syndrome, people associate it with perfectionism. Mm-hmm. So this belief that I have to perform flawlessly every time and very hard on ourselves when we don't. But there's also the knowledge version of the perfectionist, the person I call the expert, who feels like they have to know everything, who would feel shame if they were asked a question in class or a meeting and they didn't know the answer. They're constantly trying to get more credentials, more degrees, more experience before they feel themselves to be remotely qualified. you know, that kind of natural genius, they're measuring competence as being based on ease and speed, right? Mm-hmm. They expect to step into a new situation, hit the ground running, pick things up very quickly. And if they don't master things or understand things quickly, you know, they think they should come out of the womb knowing how to write a dissertation, right? then they're hard on themselves. The soloist thinks they have to do it all alone. If they got help, tutoring, mentoring, it doesn't count. And of course, the superhuman expects ourselves to perform not just in my job, but also as a parent, as a partner, community member, and so on. So we kind of hold the bar really high in all these different areas of our life.
I would imagine, too, you can have a mix of all of these five in some respects.
Yeah, and some people do. I often invite people to think about, Kate, if there's one that you could shift and make a change in, which would have the biggest positive impact for you, and to focus there.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm. What about comparing ourselves to others on social media? What has the internet done to imposter syndrome? Because of course, when the psychologists identified it in the 70s, we didn't have Facebook and all the other places that people roam on social media.
Right. Yeah. I mean, this whole Instagram culture and TikTok and so on. And I think that is a contributing factor to the finding that it is found increasingly in younger people. And you're right, you're in this constant culture of comparison. And all you see is the end result. That's what people are posting. They're not posting the 10 ways it, you know, they were horrible before they got there. They're not posting the amount of effort that went into making it look easy. And sometimes these things get reinforced, you know, on universities. I know there was in the engineering department at Stanford, there were some students who were competing for how little they had to study, right? The message there being, I'm so smart, I don't have to study, which is a horrible, horrible message to send to kids who have to struggle in different areas. Some things are easier for us and other things we really have to dig in and work hard. But you don't see that in social media.
We're talking about why some people are more susceptible to imposter syndrome than others. Valerie Young is our guide, and she's been studying imposter syndrome for decades, co-founder of the Imposter Syndrome Institute. You can join in with your situation, your story, and what you see. 800-642-1234. Email ideas at WPR.org. So how do you recognize imposter syndrome in others and help them? Because I'm thinking of Kelsey at the corporate office in Oconomowoc and a younger generation of workers who are not raising their hand and have a lot to offer at the table. What could Kelsey do in that situation?
Well, I think it's helpful to name it and not to call anybody out. You know, I wouldn't have a meeting and say, okay, raise your hand if you've ever felt this way. But more like, let's have a meeting or a discussion or a panel to talk about what imposter syndrome is, you know, what it's not. It's not a fancy term for low self-esteem. And to start questioning people's understanding of what it means to be competent and help them adopt a realistic understanding. I call it becoming a humble realist. So it's not about helping someone to become a non-imposter, because none of us are imposters unless we're pretending to be a physician when we're not. But to shift people from thinking like an imposter to thinking like a humble realist who does have a realistic understanding of what it means to be competent, as well as a healthy response to failure, mistakes, constructive criticism, which if you feel like an imposter, constructive criticism just crushes our soul. And also to understand that fear and self-doubt kind of go with the territory, but we have to keep going regardless of how frightening something might be.
When you say crushes our soul, I'm wondering, how does imposter syndrome affect you? What is your story with it?
Oh, gosh. I mean, the whole reason I started studying this, I changed my entire dissertation topic because of the findings by Clance and Ives. I was a first generation graduate student at the University of Massachusetts in Amherst. Somebody brought in the paper called The Imposter Phenomenon Amongst High Achieving Women and started describing how all these bright, capable people didn't feel like they were, you know, all that, and that they were fooling folks and they were afraid they were going to be found out. And I instantly identified, as did, by the way, all the other graduate students in the room. And I shifted my focus, and I decided to look more broadly at women's self-limiting attitudes and behaviors. In other words, what are the reasons why we might feel like an imposter, and what can we do about it from an educational point of view? Again, because I'm not a psychologist, that was my frame, was to try to understand it. Took my findings, created workshops around it, educational experiences to give people insight into what it is, how it works, their own pattern, and what they can do about it.
Valerie Young leads the Imposter Syndrome Institute, has made it her mission to address these issues of self-doubt and attributing success and accomplishment to luck, not ability. Join in on what you've gone through, how you've learned to reframe these thoughts. 800-642-1234. We'll pick this up. News update is next here on the Ideas Network. It is the morning show. I'm Kate Archer-Kent. We dig into imposter syndrome, also called imposter phenomenon, that some describe as rampant in the business world. Have you ever felt like you didn't deserve the successes you've achieved in your work? What about feeling like your accomplishments are due to a stroke of luck, being in the right place at the right time, or the sense that it's only time that someone will find you out, like feeling like a fraud? Join in with your experiences, questions about imposter syndrome, 800-642-1234. Valerie Young is co-founder of the Imposter Syndrome Institute and stays with us. Valerie, you talked about normalizing it, talking about it, but, you know, what treatment or therapy or other options might be helpful to people who feel imposter syndrome?
Yeah, that's a great question. In many ways, normalizing it in itself is a treatment. And what I mean by that, Kate, is, again, I try to do less psychologizing and more contextualizing. I want people to understand the perfectly good reasons why they or others might feel like a fraud. So that when they have a normal imposter moment, they can hit the pause button, get the view from 10,000 feet and go, well, of course I feel this way. I'm a student. Or of course I feel this way. I'm in an organizational culture that fuels self-doubt. And if I could give you an example of that last way that imposter syndrome can happen, there are certain organizational cultures. Academia is one of them, as well as medicine. I was doing a podcast for the British Medical Journal, and there was a resident there and a medical student. And the medical student especially was lamenting the lack of positive feedback in medical school. I mean, you work so hard and you get no, you know, affirmation whatsoever. In the UK, the best you can do at the end of the year, you know, at your final exam, rather, is no concern. That's the best you can do. We have no concern about you. And I said, you're right. You know, you're working so hard and you're not getting anything back. I said, on the other hand, even though you didn't realize that that was the culture you were signing up for when you went into medicine, that is the culture of medicine. It is a culture of critique. And the same thing with academia. Nobody's writing in the margins, great paragraph, good thought, right? Mm. If you're submitting something to a publication, they're only giving you feedback on where to improve. And if you don't know that, you can take it personally and it can throw you for a loop. But if you know, okay, this is the culture, you can separate yourself and make it less about you and more about the larger culture.
It seems also a very rigid approach in academia from, you know, in just looking at tenure track and the path from assistant professor to full professor, who and how you get there. That seems to be also be a very rigid structure seeped in the academy.
Oh, absolutely. When I've done faculty sessions, I put them in groups and I have them come up with a list of ways that academic culture fuels self-doubt, not just in students, but also in faculty, and tenure being one of them. And let's face it, you know, if you are in a, it's counterintuitive, right? Because you think the more successful I become, the more credentialed I become, the less I'll feel like an imposter. But the opposite happens, right? You just feel like you're fooling more people on a higher level. And academia is full of very highly educated people, which so that becomes this other kind of culture of comparison. Somebody said to me, I think it was at Michigan State, she said, this is ridiculous. I have a PhD. I shouldn't feel like an imposter. Hmm. I said, no, you feel like an imposter because you have a PhD. Hmm. Now people look at you differently. They have different expectations. They think, oh, she must be smart.
Hmm. We have so much chatter going on in our heads as well. That self-talk, talking to ourselves. And I'm just wondering, when you think about reframing some of that chatter that's going on, that's largely negative, and those cycles, those loops that you get into in your head, how do you stop that in terms of imposter syndrome? And, you know, how do you kind of end that?
That's a great question, because that's so much of where I think we need to put our effort and energy is on reframing. To me, it's about recognizing that people who don't feel like imposters, and here I mean people who are genuinely humble but have never felt like an imposter, they're no more intelligent, capable, competent than the rest of us. It's just in the exact same situation where we might feel like an imposter, they are thinking different thoughts. And which is great news, because we can learn to think like them. And I call that person a humble realist. So it's a difference, Kate, between, let's say, a student, you know, shows up at the university and says, oh, my God, everyone here is brilliant, versus saying, wow, what a lot of smart people here. I'm really going to learn a lot.
Hmm.
Or you're in your job and you're given a promotion or assignment that feels, you know, beyond you. You've never done it before. Instead of thinking, oh, my God, I have no idea what I'm doing. Hmm. To step back and go, wow, I've never done this before, so I'm going to learn a lot. Or I've never done this before, but I can figure it out. Or I've never done this before, but, you know, Kate used to do this. I'm going to get on the phone and chat with her about it.
Hmm. A humble realist, I wonder, though, I mean, failure, making mistakes, you know, that's going to happen. And, yeah. And you're going to feel bad, I would imagine. Even a humble realist will feel bad. But how do you steer that then, and, you know, keep that humble realist perspective?
Yeah, I'm really glad you said that, because it's not like you're happy that you don't get the promotion or the job or you mm-hmm. blew the big presentation, right? You can be crushingly disappointed.
Mm-hmm.
But if you gave it your best shot, then there's no shame. I mean, think about sports. We understand with sports or athletics, like, somebody's going to win and somebody's going to lose. So the losing team or the losing athlete, they could be crying on the bench. But then what do? They go watch the game tape. They figure out what went wrong. They get more coaching. They practice. And they always say, we'll get them next time. You know, Mike Massimino, he was a NASA astronaut. And some listeners might recognize him from being on the Big Bang Theory, playing himself. And he wrote a wonderful book called Spaceman, where he talked about, in part, feeling like an imposter before he went on his first shuttle deployment. So I go out, I read his book, and I get to meet him at Columbia, because he's teaching there now, and I happen to be speaking that day. So I get to meet Mike, and I said, Mike, I don't think you had imposter syndrome. He said, you don't? And I said, no, I think you had, holy crap, I'm going into outer space in a tin can syndrome. I wasn't sure how that was going to go over when I spoke at NASA, but they laughed. And the point that I made to him was, his entire book was a case study in non-imposter thinking. When he was at MIT for his master's, he got a 12 in one exam. He got an 18 in another exam. Again, crushingly disappointed. He almost dropped out, but instead he got into a study group with other students who were failing, and they all were able to raise their grades together. Hmm. Then he failed his qualifying exam to get the PhD, and he had to get the PhD to get into the astronaut training program. Again, disappointed, almost dropped out, but he got together with folks. They helped him prepare. He did more research, and he had one more chance to go back and take it. So my point is, Kate, we're all going to have adversity, setbacks, mistakes, challenges. It's what you do with them that matter.
Hmm. Talking about the real world impacts of imposter syndrome, how it impacts social capital, our trajectory. Valerie Young is our guide. She's an author, co-founder of the Imposter Syndrome Institute. You can join in with your questions, your situations, what you've encountered with these feelings and how you dealt with them. 800-642-1234. Valerie, we heard from Reggie in Milwaukee, called in and couldn't stick around, but they wondered, how a person's background and their privilege can play into their feelings of being an imposter?
Yeah, that's a great question. Without knowing specifically what Reggie had in mind, you know, if you were a legacy admission into, you know, an Ivy League school where, you know, kind of, you know, in part why you're there is because you had a family member who went to that school, you may not have feel quite as deserving getting in. Or if you knew you had a connection on the inside of an organization, because you do have privilege, right? You might be very aware of the fact that that played a key role in your success. I would add to that, though, because we're talking about, you know, people who feel like imposters externalize their accomplishments. They attribute them to luck, timing, connections, the sense that, oh, yeah, it's just because they like me, right? That's why they said my presentation was great. The point I always make in rethinking imposter syndrome is to recognize that things like luck, timing, connections, even personality can play a legitimate role in all of our success. It's what we do with these things that count.
You have studied, too, how Michelle Obama has, you know, talked about imposter syndrome and you know, approaches to it and feelings about it. What did you find there?
You know, I can't say that I researched it, per se. I wouldn't use that language. I kind of stepped back when she publicly talked about her own imposter syndrome a couple of years ago, and I decided to kind of unpack it. And I came up with a list of perfectly good reasons why Michelle Obama would feel like an imposter, because the world was like, oh, my God, how could Michelle Obama feel this way? She's so accomplished. And my perspective was, how could she not? She was first generation. She was discouraged by guidance counselors, one who told her she wasn't Princeton material. She's highly credentialed. And again, the more degrees you have, the more likely you are to feel like an imposter, ironically. She had a really good connection, right? She was the first lady because she happened to marry somebody who ended up being the president. But also importantly, as the first Black woman to be in that role, she had the weight of the world on her, this kind of pressure to represent all other African-Americans. And that's a tremendous amount of pressure and certainly can contribute to the anxiety and this belief that we have to perform perfectly all the time.
Valerie Young leads the Imposter Syndrome Institute. Her life work to put an end to this phenomenon. She's found patterns in people who experience imposter feelings. You can join in. Still time to talk. 800-642-1234. I'm Kate Archer-Kent. You're listening to The Morning Show on the Ideas Network. It is The Morning Show. I'm Kate Archer-Kent. We discuss imposter syndrome and how people who feel like imposters have unsustainable standards of competence. And we're examining the detrimental costs in the workplace, in society, how these feelings hold back people in their careers. Join in what you do to counter persistent feelings of self-doubt in your abilities, thinking you're a fraud. 800-642-1234. Valerie Young co-founded the Imposter Syndrome Institute and stays with us. Let's bring on Tom now in Middleton. Hi, Tom. What is your story?
Well, I feel like an imposter. I'm an endowed full professor at UW-Madison, and I'm very famous in my field. I'm about to receive a Lifetime Achievement Award, which only 40 people in the entire history of my field have received. And, but it's an absolute miracle. I mean, it's like being struck by lightning five times in a row that I got here. My dad died when I was three. I was raised by my mom and my grandmother. We didn't have money. If it hadn't been for going to college back then, essentially free at the University of Texas at Austin, where I got all three degrees, I wouldn't be here. So I feel like an imposter all the time. On the other hand, the paradoxical part of it, and this is something that may or may not fit this, is that I am supremely confident in my own abilities.
Hmm.
I know I'm very smart. I know I'm very creative. I think my field is done. And that is shared by others. In fact, when I win this award, my speech is going to be about this very topic, how I'm at the same time a fake, but all of you are too. And I'm just a bit, and so it's a very confusing thing to me. And so I'm sorry not to fit in a nice box for you, but that's how I feel.
Tom, thank you so much for sharing your story. Valerie, what do you make of that paradox?
I would say Tom fits perfectly in the box in a couple of ways. Let me tell you one. There was a study done at Wake Forest University where they took students who had tested high for imposter feelings. And they said, how do you think you're going to do in this exam? When the students were told no one would see the results of the exam, secretly, they felt pretty confident. But when they told them we're going to display and share the results, they lowered their expectations for how well they would do. The researchers dubbed them phony imposters. Hmm. I respectfully disagree. I think what they really uncovered is the flip side of imposter syndrome, which to Tom points that what he called a paradox is that deep down, we know we can do just about anything we set our mind to, not easily, not quickly, maybe not without help or perfectly, but we know we have what we need to achieve the majority of the goals we set for ourselves in life. It's just that imposter thinking gets in our way. You know, as I think about Tom being in academia, I did a faculty session one time, and this guy comes up to me and he's a professor and he says, what would you say if there's somebody in your department who really is an imposter? And I said, well, I'd have to understand what you mean by that. And he said, well, everybody thinks this guy's really smart, but he's not. He just works really hard. I said, is he successful? And he said, very. I said, then who cares? Who cares? But in academia, there is such a premium on being quote unquote smart. When in reality, I mean, Tom got where he got. Obviously, he's intelligent, capable, creative, resourceful, but he also worked incredibly hard. I have no doubt about it, right?
You know, Tom, talking about being raised by a mother and a grandmother, how can a caregiver help their child steer them away from these feelings?
Yeah, I get that question a lot, right? What can we do to help our children? And, you know, Tom might have got some really important messages around, you know, humility. And that might also make it difficult to stand up in front of your peers and accept these awards. And I do understand that. You know, if you were raised by humans, Kate, you do have a better chance of growing up to feel like an imposter, because being human, parents might pass along some messaging that might lead us there. So I would say doing things like not using the word smart when you talk to a kid, but focusing instead on effort. Like, you got a B, but did you do your best? Right? Because for kids, praise is like oxygen. So if you're only focusing on the one B out of everything else is an A, you're sending this message that the only thing that's acceptable is perfection. You know, other kids don't get a lot of praise for academic achievement. And there's many good reasons that, like, you know, parents might do that. Maybe they're focusing on survival. Maybe, you know, it's cultural. There's many reasons. But again, for kids, praise is like oxygen. And then sometimes parents, you know, give kids a little too much oxygen, where they're told everything that they did was remarkable. And then they become very in need of a lot of constant validation when they get out into the workplace. I do have some books at the website specifically for parents.
Mm-hmm.
One is called The Gift of Failure. I highly recommend that book. And there's also books aimed at children who are already showing signs of being perfectionists, you know, in elementary school.
Wow. You know, we haven't gone through this conversation, haven't touched on anxiety or depression. And I know you're not a psychologist, but do mental health issues, do they make imposter syndrome worse?
Yeah, the research does show that for people who are already predisposed to other conditions like depression and anxiety, that you're going to find higher rates of imposter syndrome, which I think makes sense.
Where does the research go now? where should it be taken?
Oh, that's a really good question. I mean, if I was a researcher, there's very little research on solutions. It's all looking at sources and connections between things like being, you know, firstborn or anxiety and things like that. I would love to take two groups, have one go to therapy and look at their family messages and family dynamics, which is a lot of the emphasis in therapy, and another group train them to be humble realists, and then, you know, take another snapshot 3 months from them, or even a month from them, and see if you can see any differences.
I wonder, you know, has your evolution to humble realist been smooth? I wonder, does someone relapse into these feelings, even if they think they've been able to really reframe how they see themselves?
I am so glad you asked that question, because, yeah, it's not this kind of one-time event. I mean, I don't even talk about curing imposter syndrome, Kate. I talk about it in terms of having the kind of the tools, the insight, the information. So when you do have a normal imposter moment, you can talk yourself down off that ledge more quickly. So instead of having an imposter life, you can have an imposter moment. And I encourage people not to confuse confidence with competence. This belief that if I was really competent, I'd feel confident 24/7. No, you wouldn't, right? I want people to normalize, you know, fear and self-doubt and anxiety when you're doing something new, or you're putting yourself out in public in a bigger kind of way. This is normal. It's not an indicator that you're not up to the job.
I'm thinking about all the presentations you've made around the globe, so many different college campuses. Do you have a message to teachers as they stand in front of the class as to what they would say as their students sit down for the first time in their class about imposter syndrome?
Yeah, I'd have them say, you're a student, you're here to learn. You're supposed to feel stupid, right? This is a reality of the environment that you're in. And to not get discouraged, and to take advantage of every opportunity to be in study groups or get tutoring when they need it.
So really take advantage of the things out there that would make a supportive environment. It sounds like to find your allies, find the support systems.
Absolutely. And to talk about it openly, because what they're experiencing is incredibly normal, especially in a university environment.
Valerie, thank you so much for joining us.
Thank you. I'm really happy that you invited me. I'm a big public radio fan.
Valerie Young co-founded the Imposter Syndrome Institute. She is an author. She's an international speaker and has a doctorate in education. I'm Kate Archer-Kent. You're listening to The Morning Show here on the Ideas Network.